Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Welcome back. Áine Kerr sitting in for Brendan. Now, it's difficult to think about how much dominance certain countries have over our day-to-day lives, from our internet usage to the banking systems we use. More and more, we're beginning to see just how the world's economy has become a battleground for political power manoeuvring. But what will that lead to? Political scientist at Johns Hopkins University, Henry Farrell, has a new book out, Underground Empire, and he joins us on the line to discuss how countries like America have used these invisible networks to gain control over their allies and rivals, and what the consequences are of those invisible networks. Henry, you're very welcome to the show. Reading through your book, one of the starting assumptions and takeaways readers might have is that feeling of that globalization is over as we know it. The economic ideals that maybe got us here are not what are going to see us into the future, and that we have to kind of hit a little bit of a reset, a rethink when it comes to how we think about our global economies.
Áine, I'm delighted to be with you, and I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's especially important for Ireland because a lot of Ireland's economic policy was based on the assumption that globalization was just going to keep on going. So if you think about the way that Ireland integrates into financial networks, if you think about the ways that Ireland integrates, for example, into semiconductor manufacturing, these are all globalized industries where the assumption was that the global economy was going to be a very, very peaceful place. And obviously, we're discovering now that it's anything but peaceful when we see these kinds of confrontations happening in Ukraine, and also the big confrontation that is happening between the United States and China.
So we assumed in the globalized world, you'd continue to have these free financial flows, free flows of technology. So even when we look at, let's say, technology and the internet 1.0, it was supposed to be this great equalizer. It was supposed to be kind of this like town square where we could come and feel connected to the world around us and leave a little bit more informed and educated. The reality, however, of the internet, whether it's 3.0 or 4.0, is very different today.
I think that's right, and I think that it was baked into the beginning. So if you look at the early commentary on the internet, for example, there's a now famous science fiction writer, Neal Stephenson, who comments back in the mid-1990s, he's talking to somebody who says to him, if you look at the way that the internet actually works physically, it involves all of these submarine cables, and these submarine cables tend to exit and enter into particular choke points, and so the implication is that if you take advantage of these choke points, then you can begin to listen in, then you can begin to control what is happening on the internet in some very important ways. And so we've seen that happening, so that first of all, we've seen the United States using the internet in order to conduct really, really quite massive surveillance, as was revealed in the Snowden revelations. And we've also seen authoritarian countries take control of choke points in their own countries and use those in order to make sure that their citizens don't have access to information in the ways that people used to think that they would have access 24/7.
And you mentioned surveillance there. How sophisticated did that get, I suppose, in the aftermath of 9/11? Like, that was an emergency moment with emergency powers for the United States. But your book, your analysis suggests that this wasn't a one-off. It became a consistent practice, the stepping blocks for just more interventions, more surveillance of the global financial system. And now governments world over today are using that analysis and those techniques to, yes, understand how terrorists might be communicating to each other, but it goes beyond that.
Very much so. And it all began with the fight against terrorism. And I think it is important to remember that the United States, after September 11th, 2001, found itself in a state of shock. And really, we saw the Bush administration, the George W. Bush administration, beginning to try to figure out what kinds of things it could do. And again, we know at least a substantial amount about what happened in surveillance of the internet, thanks to Snowden, although we don't know very much at all about what has happened in the decades since. But what people, I think, haven't paid attention to is how much stuff was happening, as you say, in the financial sector, Áine, where you see, for example, SWIFT, which is this very, very mundane-seeming organization that organizes financial messages, which are important in sending bank transfers from one place to another. And it effectively is put to service by the United States, even though this is breaking European law. SWIFT is based in Belgium. SWIFT is required under subpoena to provide all of this information, which is then analyzed by the CIA. And then we begin to see that gradually changing, so that not only is this being used for surveillance in the financial system, we also see how it is that it is being used, for example, to cut entire countries out of the global financial infrastructure. And this in particular is the story of Iran under the Obama administration.
In all of that, Henry Farrell, like, you're trying to find all of these connections. I think you call it, you know, it's looking at the plumbing of the global economy, from technology and platforms to then the supply chains, the surveillance measures, everything in between. Why did you set about trying to kind of find those connections and the thread lines between them?
Well, my co-author and I, Abraham Newman, we had just finished a book which was about European fights over privacy with the United States. And we began to pay attention to all of these really boring seeming systems such as SWIFT, such as the Global Dollar Clearing System, which seemed to us to be interesting and seemed to be to us to be very, very political, but people really weren't paying any sufficient attention to them. And then we wrote this article in 2019, which got a lot of attention among academics, and then we discovered later among political officials, including Trump administration officials, and then the world began to change. So the world really started to change, so that people began to notice what was happening with SWIFT. We began to see these huge fights between the United States and China over control of semiconductors. And then, of course, when we saw the Ukraine invasion of the invasion by Russia, we saw how it was that the European Union and the United States responded with these massive financial measures. And people, I think, began to really pay attention to what was at stake in this global financial warfare, in effect, that really is transforming the global economy.
And you came up with a concept which was weaponized interdependence, which I want you to explain in a moment. But you were really looking at whether it's Russia with natural gas, or the United States having the ability to remove, you know, Russian banks from the international payment system, or it could be China then retaliating against trading partners and restricting access. But you came up with this concept really to try and sound an alarm bell. But in fact, it was used by some to actually escalate the situation. But explain first, weaponized interdependence.
So weaponized interdependence, the idea is as follows. If you go back to these ideas about the internet that you're talking about earlier, one of the reasons why people thought that the internet was so free from control is that it didn't have any central points. But it turns out, in fact, that it does have these central points. It has these choke points. The ways that global networks, and this is true not only of the internet, but of financial networks and manufacturing networks as well, they tend to evolve in ways that central points appear in the network. And once that happens, if you're a government that has potential control of one of those central points, you can then weaponize it. And this is what we say is weaponized interdependence, that the global interdependent economy depends upon these networks. And as these networks become centralized, they can be increasingly weaponized, so that the United States, for example, as I say, exercise these forms of surveillance. China has been trying to push back, trying to figure out ways in which it can create its own global networks that it can use in order to press its interests and perhaps to coerce others. And so there is this new kind of warfare that is happening beneath the hood of the global economy. And this is really what the concept of weaponized interdependence was designed to get at.
Some listening might think that sounds very high level, very conceptual, even conspiratorial. How do you believe, though, is what you're talking about actually rooted in reality, rooted in real world impact, even for us here in Ireland today, that we have to be thinking about these invisible networks, as you see it, when it comes to our decision making in this country and getting ahead of problems and events?
Well, there's one very good example, which is Auguinish. So if you are familiar with a few years ago, there was a moment a couple of weeks ago where it looked like an important part of the Irish economy, and perhaps even of the European economy, was threatened because of an accident. More or less what had happened is that United States authorities had decided to go after this Russian oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, who was the owner of Rusal. And so what they did is they imposed these sanctions against against them, these financial sanctions, and against Rusal too. And so the result of that was that this plant at Orginish, which was which is owned by Rusal, suddenly found itself in ferocious trouble. It turned out, I'm sort of, it wasn't able to get paid by its suppliers. There was one point where it looked like even the ESB was going to have to cut off its electricity, because it looked like, from the ESB's perspective, as I understand it, it looked like there was worries about sanctions and worries that if they didn't obey US sanctions, that they too would find themselves potentially becoming sanctioned entities, with all sorts of results for their ability even to use actual bank accounts. And so you see how it is that all of these financial systems which underlie the world, they really have these enormous and dramatic consequences when they are weaponized in these ways. And I do, I completely appreciate your point that this sounds like it is a conspiracy theory, and it really isn't. This is all stuff that you can read about in the newspapers. What I would say as well is that this is not some kind of grand conspiracy by the United States or anybody else to try and create the world that we live in. Instead, and this is one of the very important themes of our book, the United States effectively found itself discovering all of this stuff on the fly in a very, very haphazard fashion. It wasn't planning all of this stuff. And I think one of the big questions that the United States has, and this is one of the debates happening over here at the moment, I'm in the US now, one of the big debates is, what in the name of God do we do as the thing? How do we create strategies that allow us to use this power without it going overboard? And I think this is one of the important debates in the Biden administration right now.
If we understand the unpredictability of this moment, be it 2016 elections, Brexit, a pandemic, a once-in-a-century lifetime event, war in Ukraine, and you would argue at times there wasn't enough understanding of how plates were shifting, the world was changing, and then you find yourself in a pandemic and suddenly we all start to better understand supply chains because you're looking to Italy, which closed down overnight, and suddenly you don't have car parts. If we learn the lessons of the past, how do you think Irish governments, Irish policymakers here need to get a little bit more futuristic in the mindset so that it doesn't feel sometimes as reactive as it might be to some of these real world moments, particularly when it comes to supply chains, and we can actually predict and forecast, get ahead of problems?
Well, I think that the I don't want to be sounding like I'm criticizing the Irish government ferociously, because I think that you have a lot of you have some very intelligent politicians. Politicians I know get a lot of stick on programs like this. I think that Irish politicians, by and large, have done a pretty good job. I also think that civil servants in the Department of the Taoiseach, the Department of Foreign Affairs, places like that, they have done an extraordinary job with very, very little resources. And I think Brexit has been an example of that. But what I think we see is that we need to join together the dots on all of these questions. We need, just as I say, that the United States needs to figure out its strategy, and this is a question that it is confronting at the moment. Ireland needs to figure out its strategy as well. And this is going to involve connecting together a lot of issues that usually don't get connected. When Ireland was thinking, for example, the IDA was thinking back in the 80s and 90s about its industrial policy, how it was going to attract all of these multinationals to Ireland, it obviously wasn't thinking very much about the security implications of that, because this seemed like a pure economic development question, not a security question, a question of national security. But now that we're in a world where global supply chains, as you say, are vulnerable, not just in the ways that they were during COVID, but they're vulnerable to disruption because of these fights back and forth between the United States and China. So we see United States taking one action against semiconductors and China beginning to rattle the chains of Apple in order to demonstrate its power.
Something practical like that, then. If Ireland is caught in the middle, really, of what you describe as a battlefield, and let's say you have these trade wars between a China and an America, is there a binary choice that has to be taken by Ireland of we're on one side or the other? Or do you just have to rethink some of your policies up until now when it comes to, okay, we understand that things flowed freely. We're heading into a White House election next year. This whole debate about globalization is going to play out again. Like, if we accept that there maybe are binary choices and tough decisions ahead for an Irish government and policymakers, what are those? Otherwise, you get caught in your battlefield.
So I think that the choice that Ireland fundamentally faces is that if it does come down to a one side versus another, it has to be on the side of the West, it has to be on the side of the European Union, and it has to be on the side of the United States. But this comes with a significant qualification. We don't know yet what's going to happen in 2024. And one of the things which you were alluding to there is one of the things in our book is that the Trump administration, a senior Trump official, took up our ideas about weaponized interdependence, and this was one of the sources of the fight against China. And this person took this thing that we intended as a warning and more or less said weaponized interdependence is a beautiful thing and use it against China. So then we've got to ask, what happens if 2024 we see Trump beginning to, Trump gets back in and we see a Trump administration which will be much, much more effective probably than the first Trump administration because he's gearing up. He has people who are coming in to support him in much more effective ways. And that is a situation in which both Ireland and Europe find themselves in a very, very difficult position indeed, because they're caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, Donald Trump has made no secret of the fact that he views Europe and the European Union as, in his words, quote, the biggest foe, unquote, that the United States has to face off against. But on the other hand, China is not a particularly attractive partner to want to be getting too close to either. So I think that Ireland has to figure out which side it is on. On the other, I think both Ireland and Europe need also to have some other cards to play if they find themselves in that situation where they are trapped with the United States that is becoming increasingly hostile to their interests.
So if globalization is over, as you would contend, and if Ireland right now is stuck in the middle in this battlefield, one of the debates that are playing out here is the question of NATO and Ireland's role as we think about national security, if the world around us is fundamentally shifting and maybe countries are becoming more entrenched and localized as opposed to globalized. How do you think Ireland should approach that question of national security and NATO?
So I think that this is a significant question. It's an important question. But I think that it is, to some extent, a secondary question from the point of view of Ireland's security, at least so long as NATO is primarily a military organization. So what I would say is that there are some areas where there is clear overlap between military security and the kinds of questions that I'm talking about, such as, for example, the submarine fiber optic cables that come into and go out of Ireland, which a lot of our actual information economy depends upon. But I think that I'm not going to get into the question of should Ireland join or not join NATO, because it seems to me that the focus, the overwhelming focus of Irish political debate on this question seems to me to be a mistake. That is to say, this is a significant and it's an important question. But if you really want to understand Irish security in a holistic fashion, you really need to be focusing on the economic areas as well as on the areas of traditional security. Because while Ireland is in the corner of the Atlantic, which is a relatively peaceful corner of the Atlantic, it's very, very hard to see how you would see land invasions or sea invasions or anything like that are really threatening our security in any foreseeable future. If you look at this other landscape, this landscape of global networks that Ireland is also part of, this other more electronic geography, this is a place where Ireland is quite deeply exposed. It's exposed financially. It's exposed in terms of its dependence to some extent on things like semiconductors, on the high-tech manufacturing sector. It's exposed in all of these different ways. And I really think that this is the landscape that Ireland needs to be focusing on primarily when it thinks about national security.
Just finally, Henry Farrell, all of this probably sounds a little bit negative, a little bit dark, a little bit uncertain to people listening. Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic about what is ahead for us?
Well, there's the philosopher Antonio Gramsci, he has this great phrase about what is it? Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. So I think that there are a lot of dark things happening in the world at the moment. I also think that there are some potential shoots of hope. So if, for example, I'm here in the United States, nobody would have predicted 2 or 3 years ago that it was possible for the United States to get through substantial legislation on climate change, fighting climate change. And this, of course, has produced all of these messy politics itself. But the result is that the United States is now actually taking steps there, which nobody would have predicted a few years ago. I do think that there is the possibility of mitigating a lot of these problems if United States, if China, if other countries come to the table to some extent and try to figure out what kinds of things are off limits, what kinds of things are acceptable, a little bit like the Cold War, where you saw a similar relationship between the United States and the USSR. And I do think also that you could see ways in which some of these powers could be used, for example, to help push people along the path towards a world in which people took climate change seriously. So, for example, if financial sanctions were used substantially to go after countries which really are holding out on adapting to climate change or belching carbon into the atmosphere, those kinds of things, I could see a lot of problems coming along with that, a lot of risk of imperialism, to be frank, coming along with that. But I could also see a world in which this could be usefully used to knock people's heads together and get people to coordinate on things that everybody knows have to be done, but that they're worried that they don't want to do.
Okay, well, on that note of optimism and hope and the potential for collaboration rather than competition between countries, Henry Farrell, co-author of The Underground Empire, How America Weaponized the World Economy, thank you so much for joining us back after these.
Email brendan@rte.ie.